Hello and welcome to the seventh episode of Mobile Podcast. Mobile Podcast gives you exclusive insights into the major public interest issues affecting the mobile telecommunications industry. I'm your host, Simon Clark, and in this second part of a two-part edition, we'll speak again with Motorola's chief EME scientist, Dr. Chung Kwang Cho, about his research, the international safety standards, and the importance of the design and methodology of individual studies. Dr. Chung Kwang Cho, or C.K. Cho as he is best known, is currently Chief EME Scientist and Director of the Corporate EME Research Laboratory at Motorola Laboratories in the United States, where he's responsible for radio frequency product safety. Dr. Cho's impressive career includes postings at the University of Washington and the City of Hope National Medical Center, where he conducted research using RF energy to treat cancer. His research achievements and his efforts in creating and promoting international RF safety standards earned Dr. Cho the prestigious honour of receiving the Bioelectromagnetic Society's Darsenval Award in 2006. CK's contribution to the understanding of RF biological effects is vast, with more than 190 peer-reviewed research papers and book chapters. Mobile Podcast is honoured to have Dr. C.K. Cho as our guest. This is the continuation of an interview I recorded by telephone from his office at Motorola Laboratories in Florida. Well, C.K., welcome back to the program. It's great to have you on Mobile Podcast.
Thank you, Simon. I'm glad to participate.
Well, C.K., if we can, let's resume by discussing your own research on the auditory effect of RF exposure. What are your findings and conclusions in this area?
Well, that was a long time ago. While I was a graduate student in the University of Washington in the early 70s, I was fortunate to work on the microwave auditory effect. This was an effect first observed during World War II by the military staff at their near radars. And before we worked on this project, the effect was suggested to be a non-thermal interaction with the auditory nerve. And this type of a suggestion supported the idea that the nervous system is most sensitive to the microwave exposure. So this auditory effect remained mysterious for almost 40 years. So working with my PhD advisor, Bill Guy, and the famous auditory physiologist, Bob Galambos, and he's 95 years old this year, from the University of California, San Diego, we were able to record an auditory signal from the laboratory animals. It's called cochlear microphonics. It's a signal from the ear. This results consistent with the pressure wave demonstrated in water and by Dr. Kenneth Foster of the University of Pennsylvania. And this results with humans, with animals, and water, and a supported conclusion that the mechanism of the effect is a small mechanical vibration that is detected by the inner ear. Therefore, the auditory effect is no longer a mystery. It is not an adverse effect because we can hear his things every day. And I have two reviewed papers on this subject. One published in 1982 for the Journal of Acoustic Society of America, and the other one in 2003 in the Bioelectromagnetics Journal.
Can I ask you about your later and some of your other important research? Can you tell us a little bit about that work?
Okay. Yeah, at the University of Washington in Seattle, I conducted many in vitro, that means the experiment on cells and isolated tissues, as well as on animals, both the short-term and long-term exposures. And the largest animal study was a lifetime exposure of 25 months of 200 rats exposed to the pulsed microwaves, like simulating radar, and in which a variety of health measures were investigated, including cancer, immunological effects, and central nervous system effects. And this study was published in 1992 in Bioelectromagnetics, and the results showed the lifetime microwave exposure did not affect the general health of the animals. to expose animals and cells properly, we did a lot of work on exposure system design and dosimetry. And this experience gave me a chance to improve the techniques for using radiofrequency hypothermia to treat cancer. So in 1985, I started a hypothermia research program at the City of Hope National Medical Center in Los Angeles. And I also used the dosimetry techniques to study the MRI safety in patients with metallic implants. And we had our results show anisotropic heating near some implants. So when the cell phone safety issue came up in the early 90s, our team also developed a head-only exposure system for the rats and also a self-culture exposure system for the RF bioeffect studies. But in 1998, I moved to Motorola to conduct research on RF product-related dosimetry and to ensure compliance and to continue my work on both standard safety and measurement standards.
It seems to me that one of the issues that arises in what you've just been talking about is the importance of design and methodology in individual studies. Can I ask about that in general, and perhaps more specifically, how heating or thermal effects due to absorption of RF energy fit into this question of experimental design?
Yeah, after many years of experience with RF exposure systems and dosimetry, I learned there are many pitfalls that one must be avoid that when exposing cells or animals. The artifacts are very difficult to detect. So many so-called non-thermal effects has been shown to be due to very slight difference in temperature in the RF exposed samples. So for people calling an effect non-thermal, to me it's like saying I do not know what is going on, except I believe it is not due to heating. But any effect must have a reason or explanation. If it is not due to heating, well, then due to what? So currently, there is no known mechanism other than thermal for adverse effects of the higher frequency or radio frequency exposure. So after 37 years of research, I have yet to see one repeatable low-level RF effects that has been proven to be due to something other than heating. Now, in this field, I think finding an effect is easy. Finding a repeatable low-level effect has been difficult. However, to be scientifically correct, one must have a repeatable effect before one can find a mechanism to explain it. Well, without a mechanism, the study is not complete. It's like the rice is half cooked. The auditory effect is a good example. It was first thought to be a non-thermal effect, but it is now proven to be due to a very, very small temperature change.
That takes us back, doesn't it, to the responsibility of the experimenter. You've used a really interesting Egyptian saying in the past, which is, it takes one person to throw a rock into the well, and it will take 10 people to get it out. What exactly does that mean for you in the scientific context?
Well, we have seen in my 37 years, we have seen many people come out of the paper saying there's something happening. And when this topic becomes very important, and such as genetic effect or DNA effect, and of course many people will be really careful about, is that really true? So many people try to replicate. And in the history of seeing so many so-called effects, and people try to replicate, cannot repeat it. And if in science, if something cannot be repeated, and it's not proven science. And so if somebody made a mistake at the very beginning, and I'll take many years for other people try to clear up the system, the question, and takes time, and wasting people's time to chasing for nothing.
Can I move on to the involvement you've had with the International Committee on Electromagnetic Safety of the IEEE? in the creation of safety standards for radio frequency exposure. Can mobile phone users feel confident about the adequacy of such standards?
Yes. My reason there are three. First, there have been more than 50 years of research on the safety of RF exposure. Number two, there are international science-based standards available. And number three, the all phone models must be tested to be within the compliance limits before shipping. So in terms of IEEE, we have published the first safety standard in 1966. It has been more than 40 years. And I got involved in the IEEE standard committee in 1979 when I was a junior faculty member at the University of Washington, helping my professor. He also was the chairman of the committee, Bill Guy. And I became the chairman myself of the subcommittee four in, later in 1997. And when I was at the City of Hope, and I led the subcommittee to revise the 1991 IEEE standard. And that committee had 132 members, from 24 countries around the world. And our goal at that time was to develop a science-based RF safety standard. And it's the number one is to protect, is be protective of the public health. It must be ambiguous, and also very important is to be practical to implement the standards. The other important part was to develop a new RF revised standard to would be harmonized with other international standards, such as the ICNIRP standard, and to the extent were scientifically defensible. And this subcommittee evaluated 1,300 papers on both thermal and so-called non-thermal effects. So we also calibrate our review results with other independent expert groups and health authorities around the world. And over the last 40 years, there are no credible reports showing adverse health effects for RF exposure at or below the similar exposure limits. Therefore, I'm confident that the science-based international standards protect public health.
Why then are there different radio frequency safety standards around the world? And is one of those standards more protective than another?
Well, yeah, there are differences in government regulatory limits today due to the adoption of different standards at different times. For example, in the United States, the FCC adopted IEEE 1991 limits in 1996 for the cell phones. But later, most other countries, especially in Europe, they adopted in 1998 an ICNIRP limits as recommended by the WHO. But currently, both the new IEEE and the ICNIRP limits are based on the same adverse effects threshold, the same safety factors to protect workers and the public, and the same whole body and localized dose rate. So these two organizations have different membership compositions. The ICNIRP appoints its members and does not allow industry involvement, so we cannot participate in ICNIRP. But the IEEE is open to anyone with interest. However, both organizations, although they are different in composition, both organizations develop their standards based on science from the same database. And it is important to emphasize that the new standard, IEEE standard, and the 1998 ICNIRP guidelines, they are harmonized on most major issues. They are still have some differences. As mentioned above, China has adopted the 2 watts per kilogram per 10 gram limits. This was mainly due to the IEEE limits now being the same as ICNIRP. So in the world, it's the same. So China decided to adopt the same as the ICNIRP and also the new IEEE limit. So continue the global harmonization is most desirable.
And in your view, are these international standards, as they are becoming harmonized, sufficiently protective of children? And what about children's thinner skulls?
Well, all these IEEE and ICNIRP standards, they are designed, also developed to protect all population, including children. and the elderly and the sick, they all included in there. There are safety factors in built in to protect all these different scenarios and different populations. So all these are already considered in there. There's no additional precautionary to be applied to the different groups.
And can we talk about the new technologies, things such as Wi-Fi, femtocells, WiMAX, and presumably products we haven't even thought about yet? Are those international safety standards adequate for these and for forthcoming technologies, and how are the standards updated?
Yeah, the international standards are developed to protect against adverse effects, as I said before, within the frequency range. And this is this RF frequency all the way to 300 gigahertz. So regardless of any, whatever new technology, as long as the human exposure is within the limits specified in this ignorable guidelines or IEEE standard, there's no adverse effects expected. So all the new technologies use various modulations of RF signals. And in 2003, the United States, the National Council of Radiation Protection and Measurements, or called NCRP, have published a commentary, number 18, indicating no expected adverse effects associated with modulation and low intensities, such as used in wireless communications. Also, WHO issued a fact sheet 304 in May of 2006. Here I quote, considering the very low exposure levels and research results collected today, there is no convincing scientific evidence that the weak RF signal from base stations and wireless networks cause adverse health effects, end quote.
Well, CK, once again, I should thank you very much for being on Mobile Podcast. It's been fascinating hearing about all your important work.
It's my pleasure, and thank you for your efforts.
Mobile Podcast would like to thank Dr. Cho for taking his time to appear on the program. We would also like to thank you for listening and hope you enjoyed the 7th episode produced in May 2008. Mobile Podcast will be available for download regularly at www.mmfai.org/mobile podcast or www.gsmworld.com/health. Mobile Podcast is made available for download by the Mobile Manufacturers Forum and the GSM Association. The information contained on this podcast is provided for general information purposes only and does not purport to offer legal, health, or any other professional advice. Where reference is made to a company or a specific commercial product or service, howsoever referred, no endorsement or recommendation is implied or intended. The views expressed are those of the speakers alone and do not necessarily represent those of the Mobile Manufacturers Forum or GSM Association. All guests have volunteered their time to help promote an open discussion of the issues addressed.